This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
David Pearson, on my right here, is Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Berkeley. He is a Berkeley graduate and then received his PhD from the University of Minnesota. His research interests include practice and policy in literary instruction and assessment. He's a member of the National Academy of Education and also the former dean of the College of Education at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he also at that time co-directed the Center for the Study of Reading. And before that, before coming to Berkeley, he was the John A. Hanna Distinguished Professor of Education at Michigan State University. He has served on numerous significant boards and associations dealing primarily with reading and other aspects of education, and has written voluminously. I'll just cite a couple of books of articles. First of all, Handbook of Reading Research, which is already in its third edition, and then Learning to Read, Lessons for Effective Schools and Accomplished Teachers. What could be a more significant topic for national policy? So, David, I will turn it over to you.
Thanks very much, Jack. It's a pleasure to be here today. I guess I'd like to begin by asking a question. Have you noticed how silent the candidates have been on issues of education? It's quite remarkable anyway. So we may accomplish today what no debate organizer or political candidate has yet to accomplish, to focus the campaign on issues of education. And for an individual who lives, breathes, and dies by education, I find this incomprehensible that we could be having this campaign and have so little discussion of it. Well, hopefully after the candidates view today's presentation on YouTube, they'll get the message, change their tune, and bring education into the foreground. Okay. By the way, this doesn't mean that the candidates don't have views on education. If you go to their websites, you'll find, with the exception of the latest entrant, John McCain, who hasn't, I think, just got time to get his literature up, you'll find lots of stuff on education. It's just that I think that those views haven't been able to compete with the war, the economy, healthcare, energy, immigration, and experience in answering phone calls in the middle of the night. Today we'll try to unpack some of the views that the candidates hold by addressing, the general issue of the problems in education today and what our candidates think about them. First, however, let me introduce our panelists, all of whom are very knowledgeable about and steeped in these issues of educational policy at the national level. To my far right is Ruslan Ali. She's the Vice President of Education Trust and a Founding Director of Education Trust West, the West Coast partner of Education Trust in D.C. Those organizations work for the high academic achievement of all students at all levels, with an emphasis on serving the groups of students who haven't been traditionally well served by our educational system, Latino, African American, Native American, and low-income students. Ali has held several senior positions at various organizations serving youth education, including the liaison to the president of the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, chief of staff to the LA Unified School District Board, a Board of Education president, and deputy co-director of the Advancement Project. She attended Spelman College and graduated from American University and completed her law degree at Northwestern. She practiced corporate and civil rights law and served as an adjunct member of the University of Southern California School of Law prior to her career in nonprofit advocacy. She's a member of the State Bar of California, serves on boards and advisory committees of a number of education-related organizations, including the Los Angeles Unified School District Board of Education's Curriculum and Instruction Committee and the Governor's Committee on Education Excellence. Linda Darling Hammond, Ruslan's left, is the Charles E. Ducommun Professor of Education at Stanford University, where she has launched the Stanford Educational Leadership Institute and the School Redesign Network, and serves as the faculty sponsor for the Stanford Teacher Education Program. Prior to Stanford, Linda spent several years on the faculty of Teachers College, Columbia, where, amongst other things, she was the founding executive director of the National Commission for Teaching in America's Future, the Blue Ribbon Panel that in 1996 issued a landmark report called What Matters Most, Teaching for America's Future. And it catalyzed, I think, a number of major policy changes around the United States to improve the quality of teacher education and teaching. Her research, teaching, and policy work focus on issues of teaching quality, school reform, and educational equity. Among her more than 200 publications are several award-winning books and articles. Most recently, she served as a senior author for a book entitled Powerful Learning, about to be launched by Josie Bass, and I'm pleased to promote that book since I have a chapter in it. Among her in-progress projects is a study of teaching and learning systems in high-achieving countries around the world, and we look forward to that report when it comes out. Apropos of today's session, she said it would be okay if I announced what is now public knowledge, that she is one of Obama's chief education advisors. But to demonstrate her ecumenical nature, or maybe it's just that she's hedging her bets, she has also been working on legislation in Washington to reframe accountability and teaching provisions of NCLB. Okay, working inside policy organizations and the academy over the past three decades, our third panelist, Bruce Fuller, has asked how public action best strengthens families and schools. He has helped to design policy reforms for a free-thinking California governor. I wonder who that might have been, right? Yeah. Okay. And advised opposition leaders on education reform as democracy emerged in Southern Africa. Professor Fuller has studied child care programs arising at the grassroots level or run by the state in Latin America. And a fundamental question that continues to motivate this array of research and writings is, how can central governments enrich families and schools when situated in colorfully pluralistic societies? In short, what happens when government confronts culture? Trained in political sociology, Professor Fuller's recent projects center on small-scale organizations that sprout across diverse communities, such as charter schools and preschools, which often spread in response to the clumsier gray character of central states, an understatement if ever I heard one. His current research delves on how children are socialized in diverse Mexican-American homes and what neighborhood organizations effectively do to advance their development. His recent book, Standardized Childhood, The Political and Cultural Struggle Over Early Education, examines how elite reformers often push for state incorporation of community programs, even eroding the authority and resources spread across diverse ethnic leaders. Among my favorite pieces by Professor Fuller is a powerful critique of NCLB published last year by educational researcher. A college dropout, he eventually received his PhD from Stanford University. I didn't volunteer it. It's on his website. Okay, right. Before coming to Berkeley, Professor Fuller was a research sociology at the World Bank and taught at Harvard's School of Education. I've asked each of our three panelists to begin with their best 5 to 6 minute summary of the key educational issues that we face as a nation, and that do and do not differentiate amongst the three candidates still standing. Linda, since you travel the farthest, all the way from that other school down on the flats of the peninsula, we'll start with you. And then, Ruslan, if you'll go next, and finally, Bruce.
Well, I'm going to try, since I'm in this first position, to do a little framing, and others can add on more of the comparisons of views. But about a month from now, we will be celebrating the 25th anniversary of A Nation at Risk. That was a big report that came out in 1983, which said that we were drowning in a rising tide of mediocrity, and we needed to get going on reforms to improve our schools. Shortly thereafter, in 1989, there were the governors and president met, and they issued a set of goals called Goals 2000, which included every child coming to school ready to learn, every kid graduating from high school, and being first in the world in math and science by the year 2000. Just a couple months ago, the most recent international results came out. We're 21st out of the 30 OECD countries in science and 25th out of 30 in math. Clearly, we didn't make that goal. We don't have reading scores for the United States because the Department of Education made some errors in how they proofread the test. So we can't even talk about reading in the most recent things. Evidence is that our graduation rates have been completely flat and maybe going down since A Nation at Risk, and so we're graduating maybe 70% of our kids in this country. We've gone from being first in the world in higher education participation to 15th and continuing to decline. So the next education president has an enormous task to do to get this nation on course to be engaged in the kind of education for the 21st century that other nations are very, very intensely pursuing with enormous, purposeful, systematic investments in their education system, which we haven't made really since the 1970s. Just as a quick framework for what high-achieving nations elsewhere in the world are doing, which also have much more equitable achievement, they invest in children. They have fewer kids in poverty. We have more kids in poverty than any of the industrialized nations, and right next to Mexico in that regard. About 22% of our kids are in poverty. In most of those nations, there is pretty close to universal or universal preschool and health care. Schools are funded centrally and equally. Our schools, the top 10%, spend 10 times more than the bottom 10% across the nation. And within any given state, it's a 2 or 3 to 1 ratio. They've made major investments in teaching in virtually all of the highest achieving countries. Anyone who wants to become a teacher does so completely at government expense. If you're in Singapore, you also earn a salary while you train to teach for 3 or 4 years in a preparation program, and there's lots of other investment in teaching. And then they've developed curriculum and assessment systems pointed at 21st century skills. So what does the next president need to have on their agenda? I think, first of all, they've got to create a sense of urgency about education that is sufficient to reduce our commitment in this country to inequality. The extent of inequality in both inputs and outcomes from the education system exceeds that of any other industrialized nation. And to get past that, there's going to have to be an enormous sense of urgency. In fact, most of the problem in our rankings internationally is a function of inequality. White students in this country do about as well as European students in the OECD countries. African American and Latino students do so much less well and are in schools that are so much less well-resourced that affects the entire international ranking. California is a majority, quote, minority state at this point in terms of public education. By 2025, that will be true of our public education system generally. We can't continue to think, some kids will get theirs, other kids, sorry for you, and think that our nation will be able to sustain itself that way. Early childhood education is going to have to be on the agenda, 0 to 5. I'm going to let Bruce talk more about that because he knows more than I do about all the details, but there are lots of good ideas for that going around. I think that we need a federal policy that insists that between the federal government at a much greater level of investment than we've had lately, I believe, and leverage on state governments, that we have to make progress on an equity agenda. I think states that receive federal funds need to be showing that they're making progress on adequate and equal resources for schools, equitable resources for schools, and that the federal government needs to begin to make good on its obligations for the investments that it's supposed to make for special needs students, for students in poverty. The federal commitment has been a 40% commitment of that total bill. It's now down to about 17% of what is actually being resourced by the federal government. Third, I think we need a major investment in the teaching force. We ought to have the capacity in this country, as every other industrialized nation does, to put well-qualified teachers who are well-trained in every school to ensure that they get mentoring and good professional development, and a set of incentives. A Marshall Plan for teaching that would do that would cost us actually less than 1 week of the war in Iraq, and it's possible with some purposefulness to achieve that. We need to have a standards and assessments conversation and set of activities that moves us beyond multiple choice tests, which are not used in most other nations of the world, toward the kinds of performance assessments that measure critical thinking, problem solving, and the ability to access and use resources toward the 21st century kinds of expectations that we're not developing in our schools now because we don't even include it in our accountability systems. And that's going to be an agenda around research and development. And finally, we need to make some substantial investments in innovation. This is a nation of innovation. In education, as elsewhere, we are only going to invent schools that meet the demands and expectations we have if we're able to innovate effectively and then scale up those innovations rather than leaving them at the margins of the system. And we've had no purposeful strategy for doing that, and we need to make that's a place where the R&D role of the federal government really needs to come into play. And I'm sure I went on for more than 5 minutes, so I'll stop there.
Well, we'll take some time away from a later one of your later comments, just to be equitable on this. And one of the questions we'll come back to is whether or not Barack Obama supports all the provisions that you've outlined and what sounds like a platform. Yeah. Ruslan.
Thank you, and thank you, Linda. You really hit the nail on the head when you talked about the equity argument and the opportunity and achievement gaps that plague our nation. As Linda talked about, it's not just the gap between us and now 21 and 25 other developed and developing countries. It is the gap separating our students of color, our low-income students from their more advantaged peers. And the truth is, we can't get to that first gap, the gap between us and all the other countries, without a hardcore focus and attention on the gap separating students within our own borders. How do we get there? Linda talked about many of the things that we know research tells us makes the difference, the biggest being that focus on teacher quality. I worry as I hear candidates wrestle through this issue of teacher quality that we can run the risk of focusing so much on recruitment and the fears of teacher shortages that we will miss what is hobbling poor kids and kids of color in this nation, and that is in almost every state, poor kids and kids of color have less than their fair share of what we know matters most, and that is those highly qualified, highly effective, best, strongest, however you want to define them, we know who they are in almost every school, those teachers. And far too often, poor kids and kids of color get shafted. We're not talking about unqualified, we're talking about underqualified. Conversations that tend to focus solely on the teaching profession in the big sense and the need to recruit and retain more teachers into the profession, the need to pay them more, sometimes lose a focus on the kids that have most often been underserved. We've also, as Linda mentioned, really got to go deeper with the standards movement. From where I sit, standards are among the biggest advocacy tool we have ever had in public education. For the first time, we know at every level, in every subject, what kids should know and be able to do. We got a lot of work to go to get them there. And we certainly have to work much harder to make sure our schools and their teachers have the capacity to deliver high-quality instruction in order to meet those standards. But even with all that we've come in the standards movement, there is still great disparity, for example, from the quality of California standards with those of, say, Mississippi's. And so we fear, and as we've been talking about accountability, especially post No Child Left Behind, I've talked to so many policymakers that say something like, well, what does it make sense if Mississippi, with very low standards, some would argue, that has many of their students jumping over that bar, and California, with very high standards, that doesn't have many students at all jumping over our bar of proficiency? What does that mean? It certainly is about confusion. It certainly means that still, in 2008, zip code and geography will determine rigor and quality of instruction, both at the state level and within states and within neighborhoods. So coming to a common nationwide consensus and goal, I'm not talking about federal standards, I'm not talking about national standards, but I am talking about a kind of synergy amongst the states that says that no matter what state you reside in this country, when you come out of high school, you will be equipped with the skills necessary to succeed in college, in career, and in civic participation. And the truth is, ready for work and ready for college really do mean the same thing in today's and tomorrow's economy. As Linda mentioned, we got to know more, both about what it takes to deliver that high-quality instruction, about student performance, about what our best teachers look like. We've got to do much better in this nation about getting good data systems that'll tell us the truth about what's happening in public education. Linda alluded to the fact that we still don't know for sure how many students are dropping out nationwide and within most states. Moving in data is not sexy. It certainly is not fun to talk about, and it gets real wonky real quick. But as we talk to parents up and down this state and across this nation, they are hungry to know the truth about their schools, and we don't know very much. We also talked a little bit earlier, as Linda mentioned, about the notion of pre-K and early childhood readiness, and I'm sure Bruce will talk more about that. Terribly important, but it is also important to remember that closing the pre-K readiness gap is going to close the pre-K readiness gap. It's not, in and of itself, going to close the achievement gap. In fact, what we see here far too often is early gains get lost quickly the longer students matriculate through our system. When it comes to that notion of innovation, we have a lot, as Linda said, a lot of work to do there, both from the R&D arm of the federal government and the R&D arm of traditional public schools like charters that have a little more flexibility to do things differently. In the end, it very much is where Linda started, creating a kind of sense of urgency. I look at these data, and I see Latino and African American students nationwide at the 12th grade level, for those that are left, performing at about the level of white students in the 8th grade. And I don't know how much more urgent our problems could get. Hopefully, we will seize upon, as David mentioned in his introduction, seize upon the economic insecurity of our nation to finally get that the best way to ensure our standing in this global economy is to ensure that we close the achievement gap, that we make progress for all kids, and that we make our world-class system world-class once again. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ruslan. Just a placeholder. I do want to come back to the standards issue later on and ask the question of whether standards push us to the highest or the lowest common denominator and bring up that issue just as a kind of a something that hopefully we can talk about later. Bruce.
One thing I learned when I was young and involved in professional politics and working for this governor who will remain unnamed in this room was that campaigns are, what you hear from candidates is sort of a confluence of policy ideas and the symbols that speechwriters are enamored with. And I think we're seeing that across the three remaining candidates, that there's a lot of signaling that's going on. There's a discourse that's being spoken and chatted about. And then there are a few policy ideas that surface. So I want to do a couple things very quickly. One is to just talk about three big forces that are out there, forces who kind of dominate this discourse and the way in which the candidates are responding to the discourse, and then sort of come back to adding to Ruslan and Linda's list about how we should think about policy more carefully. First of all, the discourse we're hearing is driven a lot by the middle class. Obviously, to win the presidency, you need to peel off 7 to 8% of the independent voters. Unfortunately, they tend to be white males, so it's hard to figure out what the hell they're actually thinking. But a lot of the conversation out of the campaigns is aimed at those swing voters in the middle class. So we do see kind of entitlement talk coming from Hillary's campaign. She does talk about universal preschool on the stump. She talks about universal financing for all families. When I interviewed her staff for a piece I did a few months ago, It turns out that her legislative package doesn't match her stump speech. So her legislative preschool program is focused on very poor families, and her stump speech promises free preschool for the middle class. So you see these contradictions arising in the campaign. A lot of talk about college student aid obviously has a lot of appeal to middle-class parents who are struggling to pay for college, like some of your own, I'm sure. A lot of discussion about making school investments more transparent through accountability. Even Barack Obama, who I think has sort of an interesting mixed market approach to public policy, talks about strong central state accountability. So, again, this speaking to the middle class. Secondly, labor unions. There's obviously been a huge debate over the last 25 years since The Nation at Risk as to whether teacher unions are a force for good or a force for evil. So you've got the candidates, especially the Democrats, struggling to cozy up to the teacher unions, yet to try to look a little bit independent of the teacher unions. Hillary, her playbook, though, is much more, I think, in bed with the unions. She talks about federal money for class size reduction, which is something the feds have never invested in, and as many of you know, the evaluation evidence is a little mixed on the effects of class size. She talks about federal aid to raise teacher salaries, again, something the federal government has never done. Obama, I think, takes a more interesting posture vis-a-vis the unions. He has shifted, I think, more toward the union position even since last summer, but he talks more about things like merit pay. He has a more coherent strategy, perhaps because of the lady on my right, about how do you improve the workplace day-to-day for teachers. So he doesn't come in with sort of these categorical little bullets or these silver bullets. He tries to put forward more of a strategy in terms of how we're going to improve daily life and the motivation of teachers to reduce teacher turnover and teacher retention problems. And the third force, I think, that's out there is the business community. But the business community, especially moderates, are sort of teamed up with what Tony Blair called the third way, that is trying to figure out policies that are in delivered through mixed markets. So Obama's rhetoric and his staff people talk quite specifically about mixed markets of preschools, working with community-based organizations, whereas Hillary would hand up preschools over to the K-12 system, which is what her federal legislation, proposed legislation, would do. You see this in healthcare policy. I mean, Obama's gotten beat up a little bit on healthcare reform, but it's much more of a mixed market. Let's move from the public subsidy of private companies that run healthcare. Let's try to make it more progressive. Let's finance more progressively on the poor. But let's not absorb all these things into big central government agencies. And so it's more of a third way sort of Tony Blair approach. And in that way, Obama, I think, joins this discourse that moderate business people and a lot of progressives on the left have arrived at. There's a huge battle in the Democratic Party, I think, between do we go towards universal health care, do we go towards big central institutions, or do we try to enrich mixed markets and build up from grassroots organizations, which really came from the community action days and the Great Society. So Obama and Hillary have positioned themselves, I think, differently in subtle ways in that debate. Now, finally, let me just say a couple things about long-term frameworks and kind of where the candidates may take us differently in terms of their policy theory. One is, do we focus education dollars on young kids or older kids? The foundation community is sort of like Gates has drifted towards high school reform, secondary school interventions. But the biggest effect size, as we know from the evidence, is with younger children, is sort of preventative interventions. And I don't see the candidates really talking very intelligently about this, other than I would point out again that Obama is talking more about helping families, intervening with community and neighborhood organizations. There's an organizing strategy around it, as opposed to just dropping in these little remedies into the public schools. The other long-term question, I think, is around choice. McCain weighs in terms of pro-choice, pro-charter schools. But he's also pro-NCLB. Obama and Hillary have both been very critical of NCLB. I think other than maybe Russland's organization, a few others, I think a lot of people are wagering that NCLB essentially is dead. But there's got to be a serious conversation about how we reshape the federal role in education. But McCain, I like to say McCain's strategy on accountability and choice is sort of like his view of waterboarding. He wants accountability, but he wants flexibility for choices on the ground. And he seems fairly schizophrenic in that regard. And finally, I would say that the candidates are not saying too much about what education should actually be doing with and for our children. There's very little discussion about the goals of education. Hillary and Obama both have said we're too obsessed with standardized tests, which, again, fits the discourse, but it doesn't give us much of a picture of where we're headed if we try to alter testing or if we go towards portfolio assessments, as Linda's and others have articulated. But where do we want to head in terms of the developmental goals and the educational goals for our kids? That's very hard to fit into the dominant discourse in a way that's uncontroversial. I'll stop there, David.
Great. Well, thanks very much to all of you for those provocative opening statements. Before we go on to a list of issues and questions that I have prepared for you, I'd just like to give each of you a chance to do a little crosstalk with the others if you want, just very briefly. Anyone want to say anything across the table here?
I made one comment that I thought of when Russell was talking, and it recurred for me when Bruce was talking, which is on this question of standards and goals for the system and what kind of education are we looking for, which is that, as I think you suggested, the issue is, you know, not only what kind of what height of standards are we going to have, how high are they, but what's the nature of the standards? What do we want kids to know and be able to do? What kind of thinking and so on? So I think that, as you said, through some mechanism, we're going to have to revisit what our standards are. If we look at the statements of standards in the United States and curriculum and so on, they're a mile wide and an inch deep. High-achieving countries teach half as many topics much more deeply, and they have defined increasingly, and this is really true in the Southeast Asian countries and in the Scandinavian countries, they're really pushing very far towards how kids will access resources, make sense of them, figure out how to frame problems, figure out how to solve problems, much more a new vision of knowledge than we've talked about at all in this country in the standards conversation. There's a professor here at Berkeley, those of us at Stanford don't always pay attention to what's happening across the bay, but Professor Lyman here, who's been looking at the growth of knowledge, and he publishes periodically how fast knowledge is growing. And he did a report with his colleagues recently which found that between 1999 and 2003, there was more new knowledge created in the world than in the entire history of the world preceding. If you think about that for a moment, what it means is that the notion that we have about schools, that you're going to get the facts lined up that we want kids to memorize and allocate them between kindergarten and 12th grade and make sure they get them in and then regurgitate them on a test at the end of the year, is completely useless in an era in which what you're going to have to be able to do is learn how to learn, be able to be not fact-free, but knowing, understanding how to access resources and make sense of new problems. So that relates to the problem that you said. What's the vision of education that folks have? And I do know that that's been a conversation inside the Obama campaign, and it may also be inside the Clinton campaign for all I know, but that we really have to be thinking about a different way of conceptualizing learning. And we've got to capture that in our curriculum systems. We've got to capture that in the way we think about assessment and how we support kids in their learning. We've got to make huge investments in sort of math, science, and technology, which is completely falling off the table. Some blame that on No Child Left Behind. I don't think that's the whole reason for it, but we are not making those investments. And then I would simply add the character education and civic engagement and civic education is an issue that I know, what kind of people are we trying to bring up in this country and how will they engage with each other and in their communities, I think is another piece of that that I know is an issue in that campaign.
As near as I can tell, everyone's for character education, but I don't think anyone has any suggestions for how to do it. Ruslan, you wanted to add
something.
Actually,
if you go to the website,
okay.
there's a very elaborate education plan that includes some suggestions on that point.
Ruslan, go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to loop back a little bit to the NCLB conversation, but certainly...
Actually, you know what? Let's make that a transition
okay.
to the second phase.
Okay.
In the second phase, I was going to bring up some issues or topics and then let you comment on them. So my first one is NCLB.
Okay.
So where is it?
I was going to talk about what Bruce said, I said.
Yeah.
So you want to transition to NCLB.
So comment on Bruce first and then go on to the broader issues, right?
I can comment on Bruce later. What's that? But your question specifically, David, on NCLB is?
Well, it's specifically, you know, where is it? What's likely to happen under an Obama, a Clinton, or a McCain presidency with it? And, you know, and then if you could also transform to, you know, there's NCLB specifically, but I think there's a broader issue of accountability systems in general and whether those are alive or dead under different presidencies.
Okay. No Child Left Behind, I think it's clear the current approach is not working. I say that begrudgingly. I say that begrudgingly, but I can acknowledge it. That said, the spirit of No Child Left Behind is one that I am disappointed and saddened gets so lost in this inflamed debate. For the first time in our nation's history, we had a piece of federal policy that said the achievement gap was going to be closed, never before. And I worry, hopefully not, but never since. And so we can agree that it's not working. We can agree that there is too much of a demoralized profession, both amongst young people and their instructors. And we can agree that oftentimes, rightly or wrongly, but it is the perpetrator now because someone said it's a perpetrator, that can be NCLB and testing and some of the teacher quality requirements of that act. But it is not enough to say that we just hate NCLB. It is not enough to say that it is just anti-Bush. What are we, what are Democrats, as a nation, going to do to close the achievement gap? To my following of the campaign, and I do get a pretty addicted to these things. I'm looking forward to like the two-week, somewhat, little bit of a hiatus. But I've heard one candidate mention the words achievement gap, and that is Senator Obama. I have not heard in this campaign or many of the popular stump speeches Senator Clinton talking about the achievement gap, though, as was mentioned, talking about education reform happens. First part is certainly confronting it, talking about it as a nation, not letting it die as we fix what's wrong with No Child Left Behind. No law is perfect. No law ever is. But this law in particular, I think, has some unfair things attached to it. Linda talked a little bit about investments and money, whether it be 12 cents, which some say if fully funded, you're looking at 12 cents on the dollar. You mentioned 17 cents on the dollar. Fully funded, anywhere between 12 and 17 cents on the dollar is what federal government spends on public education in states. The other 88 to 82 cents on the dollar is state responsibility. Yes, as a condition of federal aid, states ought to have to close the achievement gap. As a condition of federal aid, states ought to, as Linda talked about earlier, have to close the resource gap, not just between districts, but within districts, resulting mostly from teacher placement and where expensive teachers sit with most advantaged students. So we've got to be able to get out of the NCLB drama and flame-throwing and go back to the spirit of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, for which NCLB is just its latest iteration. Under Clinton, it was Improving America's Schools Act. The purpose is to ensure that poor students get additional resources, not to supplant, but to supplement their education. And NCLB told us, and with those additional resources, we're going to have to teach them to the same standards as we so often teach more advantaged students. I hope we don't lose that in this quagmire of the competing buckets that Bruce talked about for attention in this. The legacy of accountability, David, to the second part of your question, Hopefully we won't throw away the thermometer. I saw Peter Schrag walk into the room, columnist Peter Schrag, not too long ago. Hi, Peter. A couple of years ago, you talked about let's not throw away the thermometer just because it tells us we have a fever. I'm not sure you were talking about NCLB, but I'm often reminded of the analogy when I think about what we know now because of that act. We know more about student performance by subgroup than ever before. Let's be clear. In California, while we were testing ELL kids and testing special education kids, they were not a part of our accountability system. They totally flew under the accountability radar. NCLB forced us to think differently about that. It forced those kids to count. As we make NCLB better, as we make state accountability systems better, as we make standards deeper and richer and the assessments aligned to those standards more rich and robust, I just hope that we do not forget that these data are telling us we have an incredibly horrific crisis plaguing and hobbling most of the nation's Black, brown, and poor kids. And without some concerted effort as a nation and as states together to help them, we can't just make the problem go away because we take away strong accountability or we take away disaggregated data.
If I could just move out of my role as the moderator of the panel to take at least a little bit of a position on this, I'd like to raise one issue about NCLB and accountability systems in general, and that is that I think a lot of the issue of standards and accountability depends upon the grain size at which you conceptualize the standard, because if the standards are, you know, if you on the face of it look like, you know, the big ideas in science or mathematics or literacy or the like, then I'm all for accountability to those. But what I see happening in so many schools is that when you get down to the, you know, the very specific standards like all the letter sounds in reading or the facts in mathematics, then what happens is you create the potential for a dual curriculum, even though you're holding everyone to the same standards. Because what happens is, you know, a lot of low-income kids come to school and everyone says, well, you know, first they got to get the words right and the facts straight before they can do the what-ifs and I wonder what's. And, you know, 10 years later, those same kids are still getting the words right and the facts straight. And the truth of the matter is they never got to the what-ifs and I wonder what's. And so they don't really get to the same curriculum that rich kids have. And I think there's a real issue about how, you know, the level at which you define standards and the level at which you attach assessments to them. So having said that, I will now get out of that role and ask if anybody else wants to comment on where NCLB will and accountability systems generally, how they'll fare under the three candidates.
I'm sorry, though, but David, I do.
Yeah, go ahead. You can respond.
You're going to be on the panel. That said, and I respect that argument, especially at the elementary level, we see signs of it all the time. The same argument applies at the high school level, where poor kids and kids of color, where we don't have that sort of restricted or scripted kind of curriculum package as we do in the early grades in California. That same who gets taught to critically think, deductively reason, stretch their brains,
exactly,
and who gets taught to memorize happens. That is what, in those early days of NCLB, it was all about. It's what this president called the soft bigotry of low expectations that turned out not to be so soft. It's not the accountability system. It's not the standards themselves that perpetuate that kind of inequity. It's our delivery of them. Though we could go richer and deeper and more specific.
You know, if you listen to what the candidates say on this topic, you could kind of line them up on a continuum with John McCain saying, go NCLB, keep it in place. Obama saying, mend it, don't end it. And Hillary now saying at the top of her website, end the unfunded mandate that is No Child Left Behind. Now, lots of people are trying to figure out what that means, whether it means end the lack of funding or end the mandate or, you know, change the name. But anyway, you could put them on that continuum. I actually think that the politics of NCLB are going to be bigger than any president. So it kind of doesn't matter at some level what the candidates are saying right now. What's going to happen over the coming year, we probably won't get a bill. Pretty much everyone agrees. And some people think we may not even get one next year in 2009. But what's going to happen is more and more schools are going to be declared in need of improvement or failing. In California, there's a trajectory that shows that sort of over the next few years, close to 100% of schools, including the wealthy ones that appear to be high achieving and so on, those that are improving in their general trajectories and that are closing the gap will nonetheless be declared failing. And the pressure is going to be on Washington increasingly to do something more and more radical about the changes in the law. So the question is really going to be, what's the politics at that moment in time, less than who the president is? There'll be a whole new group of freshmen congressmen coming in on whatever agenda they have. And so I think it will be a political matter as much as anything. I hope, as Ruslan does, hope that two important goals of NCLB remain. One being the notion that we have to continue to make progress on achievement, and we've got to do that in a way that I would argue not only reduces the achievement gap, but the thing that hasn't been on the table reduces the opportunity gap that leads to the achievement gap. There was a explicit effort to change the conversation from inputs to outcomes that began in the Reagan administration, including even taking off the table the opportunity to measure inputs. So we could spend a lot of time arguing about outcomes. We do that every fall when the test scores come out. We beat our breast. We say, oh, my God, there's an achievement gap. But the resource and opportunity gap that leads to that has not been talked about or measured or looked at or worked on for a long time. And so that piece has to be on the table and hasn't been sufficiently on the table in No Child Left Behind. The other piece was the notion that all kids are entitled to qualified teachers. And we can debate the definitions and the issues around that, but the notion that kids are entitled to some kind of quality teaching is an important notion, and that, I hope, will stay on the table and we'll get better at figuring out how to do that and what it means over time. Ultimately, I think the kind of direction that we need to go has to do with creating an approach to accountability that keeps those goals front and center, but is less micromanaging. The federal government is now trying to tell states, for example, there were states that had very thoughtful assessments, kids engaged in designing and implementing scientific investigations and writing them up as part of the assessment that was scored. The Department of Education has told those states that has tried regularly to disallow those kinds of assessments that would lead to critical thinking and problem-solving skills. So some states have abandoned them. The federal government's tried to say you have to use this reading program or that reading program. The testing has to be thus and so. The amount of micromanagement has made it harder for many schools to get better at what they do. Districts had to give up successful reading programs in order to get federal funding. So we need less micromanagement from the top. There's a fallacy of hierarchical intelligence that's kind of built into the law that somehow if it's done at a higher level of government or decided further away, it will be more profound. And that's not necessarily the case. You need standards. You need good peer review. You need ways to document and research and disseminate what works. But then ultimately, you've got to let schools make decisions that implement things that are successful, and you can't have the federal government telling them you have to undo or get rid of programs that are working for you because we say so. And so I think ultimately we need less micromanagement, a more useful approach to accountability, and more strategic approaches to school improvement. Right now we really don't have a theory of action about how schools improve.
In an attempt to close the gender gap on this panel, I have a question for Professor Fuller. And it has to do with, we've talked about various ways of closing the achievement gap, and certainly that was the goal of No Child Left Behind. But another common policy ploy for closing the achievement gap is universal preschool. And I'd like to ask Professor Fuller to comment on that issue and where he thinks the candidates stand on it.
Well, if I could get 10 people to agree to buy my book, I could just pass on the question. But I have been doing a lot of work on this issue. As I mentioned, Hillary Clinton has really been very active in the early childhood area and is very articulate on this. Again, her legislative package doesn't match her stump speech, and I think it's partly because she's angling in on these middle-class voters. Obama has sort of been creeping up, working towards a universal pre-K position, whereas last summer he was more focused on targeted support for preschool. I think the evidence tells us a couple things. One is the effect sizes I mentioned earlier from quality preschool are quite respectable, and we can get a much bigger bang out of investing in improving education with young kids starting at age 2 or 3 than we get out of investing at the high school level. So I think that suggests that the candidates could become much more strategic in terms of how they would focus new dollars. On the other hand, I don't think universal financing would do much to close the achievement gap. I mean, 100 years ago, people argued for universal kindergarten, and we implemented that. And we've seen really how kindergarten just gets absorbed in the same inequalities of the school finance system. So nobody argues that universal kindergarten is helping us close the gap. If anything, it exacerbates the gap. So my beef with the universal preschool lobby is that they argue that preschool is going to help everybody, and it's also going to help poor kids. And I don't think you can have it both ways. Either it's going to reinforce early learning gaps, or it's going to close the gaps. But the advocacy groups and the two foundations that are backing this and informing the speechwriters for the candidates argue both ways.
Okay, anybody else want to comment on that, on the preschool issue?
I would just like to mention that, as Bruce mentioned, you see more movement in the Obama campaign on this lately, that part of that is a 0 to 5 conceptualization, mm-hmm. and I think that that's a really important one because family education, community supports, and early care and education before the age of 4 or 3.5 is going to be part of this issue of closing the gap.
Yeah, I think it may come out of his time in the south side of Chicago where he worked with community organizations and the CBO world. It also crosses over to the issue of family poverty. If we can help and get to these families and help these families while kids are young, then maybe we can make inroads on the denigrating effects of poverty, whereas Hillary's approach is let's give preschools to the K-12 system because they're doing such a great job with older kids, we might as well give them the 3- and 4-year-olds.
But I also, Bruce, very much appreciate your talking about the word universal. I mean, we talk a lot about unintended consequences in public education as if, oh, we didn't know. One of the things that is quite clear with all of the universal policies that I've studied is your point. They benefit the middle class. Universal class size reduction. It caused the teacher quality gap to go like this in California, pre-universal class size reduction. 5 years later, it exploded when jobs opened up in the suburbs. In other words, teachers fled. So building the civic and political will to target the very few resources we have to the students that need them the most, whether they are 6 months or 5 years or 17 years old, is going to be the biggest challenge moving forward.
So I've been collecting questions here from the audience, and I have one. This is a toss-up question. Anybody can answer it. How will the national debt affect the effectiveness of new proposed educational goals, no matter who's president?
That question is always asked when we begin to talk about domestic policy and, rarely asked when we decide to go to war. So it's going to be a question of how much whoever the president is willing to prioritize the pressing needs of the nation. My own sense is that there is some commitment, at least among both the Democratic candidates, to make some substantial investments in education, knowing that our ability to generate wages and economic growth is tightly tied to our ability to educate our population, so that it would be very short-sighted to say, well, we don't have, when we stop spending however many billions of dollars a month we're spending in Iraq, that we'll not reallocate some of that to the question of education. Again, it's going to be a political question more than anything else, but I think we have candidates who are aware of the dire need. The other piece of this that people may not be aware of but need to be thinking about, I mentioned the Times op-ed this last week called Prison Nation, which they documented that 1 out of 100 Americans are in prison, and the proportions are higher, have been in, may not be at the moment, but there's a high incarceration rate. And that means we're spending more and more of our resources in that way. Some states actually, you know, are said to predict prison beds 10 years hence from third grade reading scores. It's basically most inmates are functionally illiterate. Most of them, the vast majority, are high school dropouts. We can spend $10,000 a kid on them now, which would be a lot in California, much more than we spend per child now. We can spend $35,000 on them when they're incarcerated years later. We're now spending in 5 states as much on prisons as higher education. We're actually losing slots in higher education because of that allocation. There'll only be 3 people working, potentially working, for every person on Social Security in 2020. There were 20 workers for every person on Social Security in 1950. If one of the three is not working but is incarcerated or on the welfare side of the equation because we haven't made those investments, we can't sustain the social contract. So the ways in which those education investments intersect with all of the other allocations of our human resources and our money are enormous. And we hopefully will have the kind of leadership that understands that and understands that we can't build a future if we don't make the kind of investments we need in the people who are going to build that future for us.
Now, what it does do, though, is give fodder to the unfunded mandate, right, and the unfunded mandates. It drives a sort of sense of fear. We're seeing it play out in California right now. Yesterday I heard there was an additional $4 billion gone from the overall K-12 budget. And so, but advocates for more money, though, must also be advocates for reform. Hopefully what these tight budget times will do is both make us, as Linda suggested, prioritize what matters most, but also force us to take a good hard look at how we're distributing resources today and where we are spending those monies in a way that does not yield the best results for kids. We ought to think differently about how to spend those dollars.
Well, thanks very much. I want to close by thanking our hosts, Jack and Ethan from the Institute of Governmental Studies, and also thanking our 3 panelists for a lively trip through the politics of education in 2008. Thank you all for being here, too.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.